put your hands together along with mine, and let's welcome our Executive Director, David Rutgers.
Thank you so much, Nancy, for your incredibly kind words and also your thoughtful leadership with the ACLU, and also for being a plaintiff. It takes a lot of courage to step up and to resist when something's going wrong. So thank you so much, Nancy, and welcome, and thank you all for being here. We really, really appreciate your presence here tonight. You know, some of you are longtime members of the ACLU, but also some of you are newer to the organization, so I think that a few introductory words about who we are and what we do are probably in order. So the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon is a state affiliate of the national ACLU, and the ACLU is really dedicated to protecting and advancing the civil rights and civil liberties that are guaranteed in the U.S. Constitution. We are often both the first and the last line of defense when it comes to civil rights and civil liberties in this country. Our motto is, because freedom can't protect itself. So nationally, the ACLU has been around for almost 100 years, and here in Oregon, we have been here for a little over 60 years. And, you know, I'm not going to actually continue with a long organizational description of what we do. I think by the end of the evening, by the end of the program, if you don't already have a good sense of what we're up to, you definitely will by the end of the evening. So what we have in store is I'm going to share some brief thoughts about this critical moment in time for the country and really for the world. And then I'm going to pivot and talk a little bit about this moment in the 2017 Oregon State Legislative Session, and what's at stake, and what we're trying to push forward. And frankly, because so much of our ability to move things forward in Salem happens because of our members and grassroots folks mobilizing, we are also going to give you an opportunity tonight to be able to participate in an action to speak to the critical, your Oregon legislators that will hopefully push our agenda forward. I'm going to invite Sarah Armstrong, our communications and outreach director, up. She's going to not only talk about that legislative action, but also share a bit about our legal program and give you some updates about that work. And then I'm going to come back and I'm going to share briefly some thoughts about a campaign that we'll be launching fairly soon. And you'll actually be the first to hear about it. And then we want to make sure that we leave an opportunity for you all to ask questions of us. So we're going to create the space for that to happen. And hopefully we'll also have some time to mingle as well and really make sure that this is a community building event. So that's what we have in store for you. How does that sound? Does that work for people? Excellent. So, you know, it's been just over 6 months since the election and 4 months since the inauguration. And, you know, I don't know about you, but it seems like all of a sudden time has kind of transformed into dog years. Because since the election, I feel like I've aged like a decade. It's really... there's no question that all of you recognize the intensity of the moment that we're in right now. The Trump administration feels like an existential threat unlike anything we've really experienced. You know, when he was running for office, we described him as a one-man constitutional crisis. But the thing about it is, you know, he's no longer a single candidate that can spout off whatever like ludicrous thought that enters his head. He now has the full power of the executive branch. So, you know, this election, largely in terms of how he engaged, was set up as a referendum on this question: whose America is this? And the idea that America belongs to somehow a select privileged group is antithetical to our values. Values like freedom, equality, dignity, they don't belong to a deserving few. They belong to all of us. We operate under the principle that as human beings, we have fundamental rights. And we are not going to let America be defined in narrow and xenophobic ways. You know, when I was first outlining my remarks to talk to you tonight, I lingered much too heavily on describing this existential threat. But you all get it. I know that. So I'm not going to go there. I actually thought that would make more sense. Here's the deal. I'm going to pivot. I think it makes more sense. I want to talk about why I actually feel optimistic, even in these chilling and dangerous times. Because there's actually a lot that gives me hope right now. So first of all, I am deeply encouraged by the incredible mobilization of people in our states, in the country, and around the world. People who are providing visible signs of resistance to Trump and his hateful values and policies. You know, I was speaking to someone earlier tonight about how the Astoria plans for the march on the same day as the Women's March in D.C., that the hopes that were maybe you get a couple hundred people. And 1,400 people turned out. That is what gives me optimism. It's the 1,400 people that come out in Astoria. It's the thousands of people in the streets around the country. It's the business owners with signs in their windows welcoming everyone. You know, it's the people who dropped everything at a moment's notice on Super Bowl Sunday night when the federal court stay of Trump's first Muslim ban came in, and people rushed to the airport to welcome the first refugee family to Oregon. It was tremendous. What gives me optimism are the countless people who responded to our plea for help when ICE picked up the first DACA youth in Oregon, and collectively, the calls from people around the state to ICE literally shut down ICE's phone system, and Francisco was released within a day. There are so many collective acts of resistance and kindness that give me tremendous hope. And so I want to take a moment to thank all of you, because all of you are part of that dynamic and that movement. So thank you. The other piece that gives me optimism is, you know, we have to remember that we live in Oregon, and that means something. And on one hand, I want to be clear, it is dangerous in a number of ways to think that somehow Oregon is above the ugliness that we're seeing around the country and that swept Trump into power. Oregon exceptionalism has its limits, and I know that. And we know that in so many ways. In 2016, we spent a tremendous amount of time working to help prevent 4 different proposed statewide ballot measures from making the ballot. 3 of them were steeped in deep anti-immigrant fervor, and one of them was aimed at restricting women's rights and access to abortion and other reproductive health care. So we know that Oregon exceptionalism has its limits. That said, Oregon is in fact a place where we can absolutely move a proactive, progressive agenda forward. So we do not need to be stuck entirely in a defensive posture right now. There is a lot that's possible. And in the 2017 Oregon legislative session, which we will talk more about, it is clearly an area where we can advance reforms here. And when I say we, I really mean all of us, all of you, because part of what gives us our power to advance things in Salem at the Capitol is our ability to mobilize for collective action. You know, in the past 3 months, since the legislative session started, thousands of Oregonians from around the state have been mobilizing via the ACLU of Oregon to communicate directly to the legislators, and it has made a huge, huge difference. And I want to talk a little bit about what that looks like. So working closely with Unite Oregon and legislative leadership and other allies, we have a chance right now in 2017 to pass landmark legislation that would prevent law enforcement profiling. We have a serious chance to chip away at the mass criminalization that we're seeing, and actually racial disparity within the criminal justice system, by defelonizing the simple possession of drugs. And this is huge at a time when our U.S. Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, is trying to ramp up the war on drugs, which, by the way, I thought there was, frankly, a bipartisan consensus at this point that the war on drugs is a failed strategy. So we have a moment. Oregon has an opportunity to take a step closer to implementing a real public health approach that emphasizes treatment and prevention, not more arrests and punishment. So I want to talk more about what's at stake at the legislative session, but I am absolutely optimistic. And to be clear, although we have a very ambitious criminal justice reform agenda, our state-specific agenda is rooted also in trying to advance reproductive freedom and protecting our First Amendment rights and advancing LGBT rights and protecting privacy and advancing racial justice and also protecting the rights of immigrants and refugees. So we are far from a single-issue organization. There is a tremendous, tremendous amount of work ahead. But, you know, it is not all defensive. We need to be resilient, and we need to know that, you know, this crisis is not going to go away overnight. So we can't easily be discouraged. And I want to be clear, and I want to be here to say that we have, all of us collectively, we have what it takes. And so I want to just say that we need to remind one another that as we see someone getting overwhelmed, we see someone getting pessimistic, let's remind them that we have what it takes. The possibility of change really does start with us. And when I think about that, I'm reminded of words from a federal court judge named Learned Hand, whose legal career spanned the 19th and 20th centuries. So Learned Hand wrote, he said, "Liberty lies in the hearts of men and women. And when it dies there, no constitution, no law, no court can save it. No constitution, no law, no court can even do much to help it." So as we build our collective capacity for the fight ahead, we need to make sure, first and foremost, that we protect liberty as it lies in our hearts. We need to be clear about the values and vision of America worth fighting for, and we need to stay strong and stay together. Are you with me? Yes. So I thought I was going to get here and not be a talking head. And then we realized that Kimberly McCullough, who is our fearless legislative director, wasn't able to make it with us tonight. That, you know, she's in Salem at the Capitol in the building day in, day out, which is making travel much more difficult for her. And so so that in some way is a lead-in to say that I'm here to also then fill in for Kimberly McCullough and talk to you a little bit about the legislature. And so to some degree, I'd say the inspirational portion of tonight's program is now ended. So I think this approach is going to be a little bit more conversational, and we'll see. You know, my colleagues can let Kimberly know how I did in her stead. So You know, as I said before, the legislative moment is a place where we can absolutely push Oregon forward. It's also, though, it's worth acknowledging that the legislative session is also a place and a time where we can take a significant step back as well. And so part of how it is we gauge our success when we're engaging in the legislature, it's not just about what the bills and the policies that we're pushing forward. It's also, honestly, some of the stuff, the really terrible stuff that we help prevent. And I would say that the ACLU of Oregon probably monitors more bills than any other advocacy organization in the state, in part because of the number of issues that we cover. As I said before, it's about protecting First Amendment, our First Amendment rights. It's about advancing LGBT rights. It's about racial justice and criminal justice reform and reproductive health. And so because of the totality of what we're doing, I really just want to hit on a few highlights of key priorities of what we're trying to move right now. And we're at a critical moment in the legislative session. There's probably about 7 weeks left. And so we're in the next few weeks, we're going to see things die, and we're going to see things hopefully move forward. But this is a really critical time. We are a long-standing member of the Pro-Choice Coalition of Oregon. And that coalition has grown a tremendous amount over the past few years. It's diversified. In the history of the work around reproductive health and reproductive freedom in Oregon, we have collectively, with allies, been able to accomplish a tremendous amount. We are, I don't know if you know this, but in Oregon, we are the only state in the country that has no statutory restrictions on access to abortion. Absolutely none. That's huge. But the thing about it is, we know that the lack of legal barriers doesn't necessarily mean access. You could have health insurance, but if you have a colossal deductible, there's a bunch of, whether it's access to abortion or other preventative reproductive health needs, you might not be able to afford them. Sometimes it's geography. Sometimes it's citizenship status. Sometimes it's gender identity. So we've got a lot to do. So we've been working with allies around House Bill 3391, the Reproductive Health Equity Act. And this bill is rooted in the belief that everyone in Oregon, regardless of income, regardless of citizenship status, gender identity, the type of insurance, should have equal access to the full range of reproductive health services and the freedom to choose if and when you have children. So at a time when we're seeing attacks on people's access to healthcare coming from DC, this bill would do something that frankly no other state has been able to do. It would guarantee that residents in Oregon would receive the full range of preventative reproductive health services at zero out-of-pocket cost by filling gaps in the reproductive health coverage for those people categorically excluded from health programs, also due to citizenship status. This would prevent discrimination on reproductive health care, and it would ensure that there's access to abortion without government insurance. This is a fundamentally proactive bill that puts us in a very different position, regardless of what happens at the Supreme Court, regardless of what happens in D.C. So we have never been so close, and I think that everyone in the coalition is feeling optimistic about these chances. House Bill 3391, this is one of those situations where legislators can't hear from you too often. So another bill I want to talk briefly about is Senate Bill 496. It's a bill about grand jury recording. So this bill is fundamentally about bringing transparency to our justice system. I just want to see a show of hands. How many people in the room are familiar with the Oregon's use of grand juries? Okay, so several of you. Okay. So right now in Oregon, the way our justice system is set up is that district attorneys convene grand juries to assess whether someone should be charged with a felony. That happens for all felony charges. And it's supposed to be a check on prosecutorial power. But the problem is, with grand juries, is that it's set up to give district attorneys really complete control over the process. Because behind closed doors, it's the prosecutor who gets to decide what questions to ask, what evidence to bring, which witnesses to ask for testimony, and which witnesses to bring up, and what questions to ask them. And so this all happens behind closed doors. The defendant isn't present. The defendant's lawyer isn't present. And so there's this joke among people that work in the criminal justice world that very much reflects reality. And the joke is that a district attorney in these circumstances could essentially ensure that a grand jury would indict a farm animal for organized crime if they wanted to. They have that much control over the situation. So consistently, when efforts that have been happening for the past 20 years, mind you, to reform our grand jury process, prosecutors have consistently said, just trust us. Just trust us. You know, but there are very good reasons why large segments of our community are losing faith in our justice system. And, you know, a good example is the lack of police misconduct indictments that happen from our process, when we see practically on a daily basis video evidence of terrible things happening. And it's created a real divide because, you know, we need to be able to trust law enforcement and we need to be able to trust our justice system if it's going to be effective. So what we say is that justice shouldn't be a mystery and it shouldn't happen behind closed doors. So essentially, the grand jury recording bill would ensure that recordings are made and that those recordings would be disclosed where a public official is accused of misconduct and they're not indicted. And when there's public interest in the disclosure of that information. And I will just share that we had a mom in our office 2 days ago. And I don't want to share her identity. She's not quite ready to go public, but I do want to share a story. Her son was experiencing a mental health crisis. And she dialed 911 and to ask for help. And the help came in the form of sheriff deputies. And soon after that, her son was shot and killed in her home. And in this terrible situation, you know, when you're grappling with losing a loved one, you want answers. And the attorney that she was asking for said to the county district attorney, "We need you to record the grand jury hearing on this case." And lo and behold, not only did that not happen, they are not even making available the notes from the grand jury case that was supposed to get to the bottom of this and find out whether or not actually there was clear misconduct and that someone should be held accountable. So this is why we say justice doesn't happen behind closed doors. And the time for change is now, and we have a legitimate shot at making it happen. So, all right, so I'm going to press on. I'm sorry, there's two other things that I really want to talk to you about. Yeah, that's Senate Bill 496. Senate Bill 496. So, all right, so just two other bills, and then I'm going to kick it over to my colleague who... Oh, I'm sorry, I'm going to kick it over to Natalie. Okay. So... So House Bill 2813, Internet Privacy. So, you know, there's this question. Should companies like DirecTV, Comcast, whoever you get your internet from, should they be able to sell information about the websites you visit without your permission? We say that too. We totally agree with you. No, the answer is no. But unfortunately, Congress in D.C. basically passed a bill which Trump signed, which removes that critical consumer protection around internet privacy. And we know that for most people, right, using the internet, it's a necessity. It's not a luxury, right? We need it for work, we need it for school, to check our bank balance, to order medication. And so we shouldn't have to choose between our personal privacy and fulfilling basic needs. So this bill would essentially be designed to put statewide protections in place for everyone in Oregon to prevent internet service providers from collecting data and sharing it and selling it without your individual permission. And that's huge, and we have a legitimate shot at moving this forward because we know that the internet it's essential. So this is a perfect place that if we can move this bill forward, it's a perfect example of how states can pass bills that push back on the Trump agenda, that we can be proactive about defending ourselves here in Oregon. So you're going to hear a little bit more about this from Natalie, who's about to come up. So, all right, the last thing I would just want to say, I mentioned this before in my opening remarks, but House Bill 2355 would be huge, huge, huge. I'm sorry, that sounded a little bit like Trump. It's like, it's like the only two adjectives he knows are huge and big. Big. Yeah. So House Bill 2355 does two things to advance our criminal justice system. It would put Oregon as one of the leading states in terms of trying to address law enforcement profiling. So right now, it is completely voluntary for law enforcement agencies in the state to collect and report demographic data based on their stops. And so when it's voluntary, guess what? No one does it. So I can count on the fingers of one hand the number of law enforcement agencies that do that. So this bill would essentially mandate the collection and reporting of stop data, of demographic data based on both traffic stops and pedestrian stops. And then the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission would do pretty high-level analysis as a way to identify the places where there are problems. And it would also, when law enforcement agencies are experiencing serious problems, it would provide support and assistance from the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to be able to help move them past these serious problems. So we think that this would be huge. I think that there's only two other states that do this, Connecticut and California. So I said this before, but this bill, House Bill 2355, would also defelonize simple possession of drugs. And we know that, the war on drugs is a failure. And we know that more arrests and punishment aren't going to get it done. This isn't a decriminalization measure. It just makes it a misdemeanor. Because what we know is that, good policy helps people rebuild their lives. But felony convictions don't do that. They make it much, much harder for people to rebuild their lives. A felony conviction for simple possession follows you around. It makes it harder for you to get a job. It makes it harder for you to get employment. I'm sorry, to find housing. It makes it harder for you to get access to student loans and a better education. So we need to be clear that Oregon can do something different. And that if we start to emphasize treatment and prevention, we're going to get a lot farther. And it's also worth noting, too, that, we are on the verge of opening a new women's prison in Oregon. And at a time when this state is experiencing a $1.8 billion deficit And we're on the verge of seeing the legislature pass a cuts budget that would do serious damage to life-saving programs and services. The idea that we're on the verge of opening a new women's prison is it's incomprehensible. In order for us to avoid that, we need a smarter approach to justice. And I'm not saying that the defalonization of simple possession of drugs is all of what we need to do, but it's certainly a step in the right direction. And so there's a lot at stake. I'm clearly not giving you the full meal deal when it comes to a legislative session, but I wanted to give you some sense of what's at stake. And I also want to invite Natalie Lerner up, who is really has been a star intern for us, who's helped organize Lobby Day. I could provide a long list. But she's going to give you some sense of how it is you can support pieces of this legislative agenda right now, here, tonight, as we speak.
Thank you. So before I tell you all how you can get involved in helping us around the issues that David just talked about, I want to talk about one of the highlights for me personally, and I think for the ACLU of Oregon generally, from this 2017 legislative session, and that was our Lobby Day. So during our Lobby Day, more than 400 of our supporters signed up to come talk to their legislators in Salem about the bills that David just told you about. So, unfortunately, our Lobby Day is behind us, but that does not mean that you all cannot still help us. So, before we get to this activity, actually, I wanted to talk to you about our action alerts. So, this is an awesome opportunity if you go to this website and sign up to receive alerts from us. We will tell you when is the right time to send an email to your legislator and express to them how you feel about the importance of our priority bills. Just last week, we sent out an action alert, and over 2,000 people responded to it. And that is really powerful for your legislators to hear from you. What is even more powerful than sending them an email is sending them a handwritten postcard. And that is what we're going to do here tonight. So up here, we have the information about the legislators that represent Astoria. If those are not your legislators, you can go to this website to find them. But everybody should have a packet with a join, a We the People postcard, and a pen. Is there anybody who doesn't have one? If you don't have one, go ahead and raise your hand, and our volunteers and colleagues in the back will help you out. All right, keep those hands raised. Thank you. So what we're going to do with these pieces of paper, these postcards, is we are going to write to our legislators about either the internet privacy bill that David just talked about or the defalonization bill that he talked about. And in your packet, you should have a little piece of paper that also gives you some language around these bills. We encourage you to take a look at that, but also to really use your own words and talk about what's compelling to these issues, about these issues to you. And another really important piece of this process is we want to encourage you to turn to your neighbor and spend a couple minutes before you start writing talking about why you care about the issue that you're going to write about. You know, that can help you clarify some thoughts and maybe also just think about some pieces of these issues that you might not have seen beforehand. So to recap, I know it's a lot of information really quickly. We are going to send a postcard to your senator and your representative, and you're going to choose either one of the issues for both of them, or you can do one issue for each. And you're going to write to them using some of the language that we've given you if you'd like, and or your own language. And one awesome way to develop that language is to chat with your neighbors. So does that make sense to everybody? And when you're done writing them, hand them back to Christina and Shelley, and some volunteers will be collecting them, and we will mail them out for you. All right, so while you're doing that and finishing up your postcards, I am going to welcome Sarah Armstrong, who is our Communications and Outreach Director up here, and she's going to talk to you a little bit about our legal program. Thank you.
Well, thank you everyone again for coming out tonight. I'm excited to give you just a couple, I'm just going to give you a few snapshots from our legal program. And just for a little overview, at any given time, we have usually between 30 and 40 active cases on our docket. Some of those cases take a long time, like Nancy's case, to work their whole way through the courts. As they say, the wheels of justice are slow, and that is true. That is really true. But we have some really current stuff that we thought you'd be interested in learning about here today. So first up, I wanted to tell you about one of our cases on behalf of plaintiff Carrie Medina. Carrie Medina was she was really interested in filming police encounters, like before it was a thing, you know, before it was a thing we were used to seeing on the news every night. She and a few others co-founded a group called Film the Police Portland, and they would go out and film police encounters. And she thought of herself, she called herself a camera of accountability, because she felt that when she stood there with her camera filming, that it made everyone involved in the situation sort of be reminded that the eyes of the public were on them, and that it was an accountability tool. And she also was a live streamer. She would go out to like protests. In fact, all around the country, she would go to protests, and she had a live streaming channel that lots of people would tune in whenever she would go live to see what she was up to. One day she was taking the bus home from work, and she heard people out on the bus say, "Ooh, that must have hurt." And she turned and looked and saw that a bunch of police had tackled someone on the ground. And because she was already inclined to film the police, she decided to get off the bus and pull out her camera and start a live stream. And since she was an experienced live streamer, she held up her camera and she was just narrating the events as she went. Like, "I see there's, you know, four officers over there. I also see a gray SUV here." She's just kind of going through. By the time her live stream started, the person was already in handcuffs and in the police car. So the main action was already over of this encounter. But all of a sudden, the police officers started to take a very big interest in her and what she was doing. And an officer walked over and demanded to see her phone. And she told him no. She asserted her Fourth Amendment right to be free from unreasonable searches. And unfortunately, rather than respect her rights, the officer grabbed her phone, twisted her arm, and took the phone away from her. It cut her. She was live streaming, though, so this all happened on the internet. But it cut off the live stream when he twisted her arm around. At the time, she took it to the local news media, and it got a good conversation started. And so that's how we found out about it. And we ended up taking the case and filing a lawsuit on her behalf to make it clear that the public has the right to film police, and she did have the right not to have her phone taken away from her in that way. So I'm really happy to announce that was way back in 2015 that we filed the lawsuit. The incident actually happened in 2013, and just 2 months ago, last month, we settled that lawsuit favorably for her. So hooray! She was not interested in seeking monetary damages. She was only interested in seeking policy changes, and so that's what she got. Because if she was on the TriMet bus in Portland, there are actually multiple police agencies involved, and so the city of Portland, the city of Gresham, and TriMet, the Tri-County bus train transportation group, they all had to agree to implement new policies and training for officers so that everyone would know that the public has the right to film police. Yeah. We also, in that same kind of movement to raise the awareness about the public's right to film, We also launched an app called Mobile Justice Oregon. Does anyone in the room have Mobile Justice Oregon? All right, a few of you. Yay. Well, you and about 22,000 other Oregonians have downloaded Mobile Justice Oregon. It's a free app. It says 20, but it just grows every day. It's a free app that allows users like you to take a video, and the video, what's special about it, because you can do that with your phone anytime, what's special about it is that that video through the app is automatically uploaded to the ACLU for review. Yeah, so no one can delete or destroy the file off of your phone. And a copy is also saved on your phone, so you kind of have it in two places. We have a team of volunteers that watch all the videos and look for evidence of police misconduct. When we launched that, it wasn't as widely known that the public, it seemed like it was still kind of a question whether or not people were allowed to use their phones to phone police, but all of a sudden everyone had these phones. Also, there was an Oregon law, an eavesdropping law, that said that you were required to give notice before you made an audio recording of people in public. And that was being cited by officers as reasons that people weren't allowed to film. Even though we kind of always thought that just holding your phone up was a notice enough, everybody kind of knows what that means these days, the law was outdated. And actually, people who are on our action alerts back in 2015 passed an update to that law that made it clear that the public had the right to film. But even after all that, even after Carrie Medina's case, we still hear from people who are hassled or bullied or told to stop filming when they are witnessing police encounters. So this is one of those civil liberties issues that we just have to keep working on. But I thought you'd be interested to know about that victory. Next up, David's talked a little bit about what happened in the airports after the Muslim ban was signed, the executive order was signed into law by President Trump. And as you saw, as I'm sure you all saw in the news, or maybe some of you made a trip to Portland International Airport, a lot of people came out instantly to protest that, which was just so, so exciting and really, I think, pushed the judges who were looking at those the lawsuits that were filed to see it really, I think it really moves them when they see that the public rejects policies like this. We were really proud here in Oregon to mobilize attorneys in Portland International Airport right away. We worked not just with the ACLU, but volunteer attorneys also from the American Immigration Lawyers Association, or AILA. They organize, you know, in Google spreadsheets to make sure that there were always lawyers at Portland International Airport for every international flight that came in through there. Portland International Airport is our gateway to the world. So that the refugee and Muslim ban, it has an effect on everybody who uses that airport. Unfortunately, even when people were detained by Customs and Border Protection at the airport, those lawyers weren't allowed to go back there to talk to people, even though they were there to provide free legal counsel to them. But what they were able to do is connect with the people's families and watch as they waited and waited and waited and waited for their family member to come out. You know, can imagine what that scene would be like, knowing that this travel ban has been put into place in a totally chaotic manner, expecting your family member or your business associate or your exchange student to come out of the airport gate and they're not being there. And so we were able to connect with families and with people who were expecting loved ones. But again, those lawyers weren't allowed to go back during the interrogations by Customs and Border Protection. So, and I was really, really proud of this. And there were lawsuits filed all across the country right away against the executive order. And I was really, really proud that the ACLU of Oregon, on behalf of our members, But representing Unite Oregon, which is another social justice organization that is led by immigrants and rural Oregonians. So on their behalf and all of our members' behalf, we filed a lawsuit right here in Oregon for Portland International Airport against the executive order. So Oregon could have a voice in this and say that we reject this inhumane policy from the Trump administration. Yeah. Luckily, courts started striking down, you know, they put a stay on the ban already, so our lawsuit is just kind of on hold while these other cases move forward. But we were still so proud to get our piece in there. And the unique part about our lawsuit was that part about whether or not lawyers can go back and be with a client during an interrogation at Customs. So we have a unique piece of it. We don't know if our case would ever get up there because these other cases are already working their way through. And so far, every time a court has reviewed it, they've also said that this ban is unconstitutional and un-American and has no place in our country. Yeah. Oh yeah, here's some people at the airport protesting. We also, just as an aside, we also live streamed that on our Facebook page and our Twitter account. And on Super Bowl Sunday night, this first refugee family that was allowed to come in after the stay was put on the ban. And we had 256,000 people watch that live. Yeah, it was really exciting. And the way that Facebook works, more and more people watched it at, you know, not live. And altogether, over 1 million people have watched that video. So were you any of them? Okay, so we have about 60 more views coming up, right after this. A second piece. Oh, do you have a question? That's still up on our Facebook. It's saved there. So it's facebook.com/ACLU of Oregon. We had our phones going. It's crazy what these phones can do. Beaming live from that special moment. And people, it was just the right time and the right moment. And people wanted to see some happy news, I think.
And does it get uploaded to a YouTube video as well?
A lot of times I'll save them on our YouTube too. That one is actually really long because we thought they were going to come out right away, but it took more like 30 minutes. But I could probably put it up there if that is YouTube a better place for you?
Not necessarily, but it's for some people.
Yeah, if you shuffle through our Facebook videos, you'll find it. We actually do videos frequently. We're going to do one coming right up next week with more details about our legislative session, though you may already know it all from tonight. And we try to do those regularly. We've gone on and done like protester know your rights and things like that on our Facebook, and they're saved there, so you don't have to be watching it in real time to get that information. A second part of the airport sort of lawsuits or the travel ban lawsuits was a Freedom of Information Act request that we filed. We coordinated with ACLU affiliates all across the country, and so that was really powerful and got the attention of the public and also hopefully the government. Though I will say, they did not respond in a timely manner. Not surprisingly, so 50 ACLU affiliates filed these demands that covered 55 airports. And we wanted to know, this was after the court had said, you can't do it anymore, you can't block people from coming in. But we were still seeing reports in the media that people were still being blocked from coming in. People were being tricked into signing away their rights to be here and put on planes and sent back to wherever they were coming from. And so we filed these to see how are these orders actually being carried out? How are the court orders being carried out? What's really happening with Customs and Border Protection? And like I said, they did not respond in a timely manner. So we actually filed a lawsuit against our regional Customs and Border Protection office in coordination with another group of affiliates. So there were 13 of those lawsuits that were filed. So just so you know, here in Oregon, we're leading the fight in this in all of the legal, or we're part of like the front line, I guess, of the fight against these cruel executive orders from the Trump administration. Yeah. Okay. And you want to come up? So I thought by this point you might be bored of hearing me talk, so we have a short video to explain our next case. It actually isn't a typical legal case, but it is really indicative of the kind of work that we do, because sometimes it doesn't take actually filing a lawsuit. Sometimes we can just raise awareness at the media. We can also send like a stern letter, and sometimes that's enough. And so this case, David kind of mentioned already, Francisco Rodriguez is a dreamer. He's lived in Oregon since he was 6 years old. He also, this video will tell you more about him, but he was picked up from his home. Agents were outside his door, knocking on the door at 7:30 a.m., woke up the family on a Sunday morning, and took him away. And his family, luckily, you know, started reaching out through their church, calling people, and eventually they got all these advocates activated, and advocates shared the story, and the public heard about it, and there was a massive outcry. And as you heard from David, he was in detention in Tacoma. He was taken up there, but they let him out the next day and sent him home. He is still facing deportation proceedings, so his fight is not over. And unfortunately, his story is not unique either. But let's watch this short video that sort of sums it up. It's one of those reading videos, so if you have a problem, I'll explain it at the end. Ready?
I'm the only one who actually heard the pounding at the door. And they put him in handcuffs and took him. Didn't get to say bye or anything.
If ICE comes to your door and they don't have a warrant for your arrest signed by a judge, you do not have to answer the door, you do not have to speak to them, and you do not have to let them in. Frankly, somebody who is a DACA recipient, a DACA participant, should not have their DACA status revoked for something like this.
In many ways, all American kid, that young man, right here when he was 5 years old.
Video that Fusion put together, and that how did that go? Could you hear it mostly? Okay, so you got the gist of it. Basically, Francisco was a recipient of DACA, and DACA stands for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. That's the program that President Obama put in place to address people who were brought here when they were kids, but had to live in the shadows because they weren't able to. They could go to school up until they graduated high school, and after that they weren't eligible to get financial aid for college, though here in Oregon we passed a law that made them eligible. They also aren't allowed to work, and so DACA has really been a life-changing program, and it also was a promise that we made to them, because when we told young people to sign up for DACA, we collect their biometric information, like their fingerprints, and then their address, and put them in a database. And it always was the promise that if by going into this program, submitting yourself to the vetting, that would not then be turned around and used against you. But unfortunately, that's exactly what's happening. We've seen that at this point, if you have a touch with the criminal justice system, you're going to be on ICE's radar. Whether or not it's a crime that would qualify you to lose DACA, there was another young man named Emmanuel who had a really similar story. He had some misdemeanor charges. those wouldn't take away your DACA, but they got him on ICE's radar. His story was particularly sad because he had been in a car accident, or he was actually hit by a car, and both his legs were broken. He was in the hospital for 6 weeks and got picked up by ICE a few weeks after that, so he was still healing. He still had, like, open wounds and stuff. He also suffered from bipolar disorder, and so his family was extremely concerned for his safety. But again, this story got out, and people like you called ICE, and they eventually released him on bond. Again, both of those young men are still facing deportation proceedings, so they still have a long road ahead of them. And really, it's unimaginable to me to think about somebody who is an Oregonian, who grew up here for almost their whole life, even if they made a mistake and got in trouble, having the punishment mean being going back to a country where they, like, really have, it has nothing to do with where their family is, where their lives are, and everyone that they love. It's quite distressing. So, sorry, that one was a more sad case, but with a happy ending that both of these young men are home now. But on the same note, and just lastly, I was going to tell you about what's going on at NORCOR. And NORCOR stands for the Northern Oregon Regional Correctional Facility. This is a four-county jail that's out in the Dalles, Oregon. I think do you know that there's an ICE detention center in Tacoma? Okay. Well, in the Dalles, this county jail is also taking, like, overflow maybe from Tacoma. So ICE has a contract with NORCOR, an Oregon facility, to hold ICE detainees. You look surprised, and you're not the only one. Most people think that, including us, the ACLU of Oregon, think that Oregon's unique law that disentangles state and local resources from federal immigration enforcement should mean that there wouldn't be ICE detainees being held in an Oregon facility. So first of all, we've raised awareness about that, and we've gone out in public and said, we think that they're violating this state law. But another kind of sad aspect of what's going on at NORCOR is that they're actually ramping up how many people they're holding right now. I think one of the side effects of creating a mass deportation group of people and, like, a whole operation, I guess, is that that means that there's going to be more and more people held in detention as their cases make their way through the completely slow and bogged down immigration courts. Also, people who are held, who are picked up by ICE, their bonds and bail, they're basically bail money or their bonds, are exorbitantly high. I'm talking $25,000, $30,000. So they're out of reach for a lot of people who are in ICE detention. And furthermore, the conditions in these detention centers have been protested by the detainees. Many people have been there for a long time, months and months and years, as they wait. In Tacoma, over 750 detainees have gone on hunger strike over the last month or so to protest their conditions. At least, and as they've also been starting to move people over to NORCOR, some of those hunger strikers, the hunger strike has basically migrated to NORCOR. So here in Oregon, we also had ICE detainee hunger strikers. When we found out that they were here in Oregon, we sent out our staff and volunteer attorneys to meet with the detainees. It's really actually hard to meet with them when they're at NORCOR, unless you're a lawyer or a member of the clergy, and the clergy are restricted only to 2 days a week. So we went in and helped find out what was going on, why were they on hunger strike, what were their demands. We sent a message out to our supporters, and asked people to join us in the Dalles for a protest. There were local activists that were out there every day protesting that, you know, to say get ICE out of NORCOR. And I'm happy to report that the hunger strikers ended their hunger strike because they received word from the jail administration that some of their demands would be met. And their demands included access to a microwave so that they could have more than one hot meal a day. They wanted to be outside for more than 1 hour a day. Most of the time, their hour was before the sun came up. And they were not actually outside. They're kind of like in a courtyard. They also just wanted access to the other, to programs that other just regular inmates of NorCor could, like the kinds of things they could get. And I got to tell you, NorCor is, there's really no county jail you want to go to, okay? And NorCor is not one of them, if that makes sense. That was a double negative, but you guys got me, okay. NorCor, the conditions there, you know, it's not a fun place to go, but the ICE detainees are being held without access even to the minimal programs that are available to regular inmates. So, for example, they weren't allowed to go to AA, like people who wanted to go to an AA meeting, things like that. In addition, the cost for them to call, they weren't allowed to have in-person visits from their family. They had to use an expensive video conferencing system, things like that. How does ICE get permission to use that facility? They entered into an agreement with the facility. The facility, it's kind of shocking. It is. We're looking into it more deeply, I'll tell you that.
Agree.
Yeah, I agree. NorCor is not private. It's the four counties that run it. Okay, so that was my brief legal update. Oh, one more question. Mm-hmm. Do you want to answer that? Yeah. David wants to jump in. This is his area of expertise. So thank you all so much. I appreciate it.
So I'll just say a few things super quickly. It's just worth noting that, first of all, we don't have any privately run prisons in Oregon. And there are... That's a great thing, and I think that will continue to be the case, which is not to say, though, that there aren't privately run elements of some of what happens in our prisons and jails. So, for instance, a lot of Oregon-based jails might outsource healthcare, for example. But the thing I wanted to say about privately run prisons, which are terrible, and the conditions are always terrible, is that... the organizing around privately run prisons was working really well and was picking up steam. And the privately run prison industry, the stock since the election has more than doubled. And that's happened because the industry knows, essentially, that Trump's policies are going to butter their bread, and that the largest growth in privately run prison industry in the country for the past decade has been immigration, has been immigrant detention prisons. So it is an area that needs focus, although in Oregon, I'd say it probably less attention. Yeah, let me tell you the story of why Oregon actually doesn't have any privately run prisons. First of all, I'd say we still have strong labor unions, but there was a point about 15 years ago where we were shipping women prisoners out of state to a privately run prison in Arizona, and it wasn't just one incident. There was a rash of sexual assaults that happened on the Oregon women prisoners that we exported out of the state. And horrific things were happening, and that this actually brought light to the terrible conditions that were happening in this particular privately run prison in Arizona, which actually forced the legislature to pass a law that is still in place that we would never actually ever hold Oregon prisoners in a privately run prison. And so let's hold on to that. So here's the deal. I'm gonna show two 1-minute videos, and I'm gonna speak for maybe like 3 or 4 minutes about a new area of focus of ours. But I really wanna. We've been talking a lot. So are we going Q&A venue? Okay. And then so I wanna actually speed it up a little bit and introduce Shelley, and then we're gonna open it up for more questions and answers and conversation. So we've been talking a lot about criminal justice, and it seems like there's a lot of people in the room that are interested in criminal justice reform, which I'm really excited about. It's a particular passion of mine. And there's a new area that I think deserves a great deal. There's a new area that deserves a great deal of attention. So there's 2 1-minute back-to-back videos that will give you some sense of where we're going.
Why is Oregon's criminal justice system so messed up? We're still putting people behind bars for being mentally ill, homeless, or addicted to drugs. We're still sentencing people of color much more harshly. We're squandering huge amounts of taxpayer money on prisons. At a time when crucial services like schools and healthcare are being cut, tough on crime strategies like the war on drugs have failed. We know the current system isn't working. We know Oregonians are ready for change. Why can't we fix this? Because too many elected district attorneys are unwilling to change. And they're the most powerful people in the criminal justice system. It's time we hold them accountable.
If someone gets arrested, who decides what happens next? Not the police, not a judge. It's the district attorney. The DA is the most powerful person in the criminal justice system, the top prosecutor in each county. The DA decides whether someone goes free or is charged, how severely to charge someone, and the number of charges they face, and whether to charge a youth as an adult. It's the DA who decides if someone gets access to treatment or is put in jail. The DA determines if people are treated fairly, regardless of who they are or what they look like. Whether to charge a police officer with misconduct, and when to pursue the death penalty. District attorneys have enormous power, including the ability to reform our criminal justice system. As elected officials, they should report to us. Help us make sure they do.
So I'm in a room with a bunch of really politically active and conscious people. And so some of the things that I'm going to say briefly won't be news to you. But you know, having worked around criminal justice reform in Oregon for the past 15 years, I know that the biggest block to moving criminal justice reform forward at the state capitol has actually been the District Attorneys Association. And so, although all of you may know who your district attorney is, we're Josh Marquis, that 23% only 23% of Oregonians can actually name their district attorney. They're the most powerful people in the criminal justice system. Most people don't know who they are. 8 out of every 10 DA race election in the state is uncontested. And so DAs essentially feel like they can do whatever they want to do. They have the ultimate job security. People don't know who they are, so they're not being held accountable. And so we recognize that when we think about leverages for change, that if we want to see change in the criminal justice system, we're going to need to be investing in voter education so that more people understand that the DA is an elected position who are accountable to voters as constituents, and we need to start communicating collectively the values that we have, that we want to see imbued in our justice system, the policies that we want to see move forward, and we need to be holding them accountable like we hold our legislators accountable. And as we do more of that, we are likely to see significant changes. Because I will tell you right now that as a collective, and I know that there are some reform-minded DAs who are doing good work, but as a general collective, district attorneys in Oregon have been keeping our system really like locked in the 1990s, which is one of the reasons why we're on the verge of opening a new women's prison. And that's not the reality that I want to live in Oregon, right? I want to see a system that's focused on prevention, on treatment, not more arrests and punishment. So that this is just a quick preview of where we're going when we think about criminal justice reform efforts in Oregon. I hope to be back here sometime soon to talk to you in more detail about that. The next election for DAs in the state is about a year from now. We have a lot of work to do between now and then. To be clear, the ACLU is a nonpartisan organization. We do not make endorsements around candidates, but that doesn't mean that we're not willing to actually hold electeds accountable. It doesn't mean that we're not willing to actually engage in voter education so that you know what kind of choices that you have. And you all know better than I do, perhaps, since you live here in Clatsop County, it's got to be a hard thing, right, when your district attorney is the national voice of the death penalty, is the national voice of why the government should continue to execute people, even though we know innocent people have been killed, even though we know there's massive racial disparity in the use of the death penalty. So this is just a kind of quick and dirty overview of something, a direction that we want to be heading in. When we get to the Q&A part of this, I'd actually love to be able to get a read of the room to get a sense of if I'm talking your language or if you actually have some concerns about what I'm saying. But we're not there yet, but we're almost. But before we get there, I want to bring Shelley Hunter, our development director, up to get us there. Thank you, Shelley.
Thank you, guys, and good evening, Astoria. We are here at your invitation and so glad to be here. I want to offer you thanks for inviting me and the rest of my colleagues. We're excited. I mean, it's an amazing opportunity to come sit in a room of like minds. It's an amazing opportunity to be here on an evening like this to talk to you about what we're doing. It's been a number of years since we've been here, far too long, but we are getting out and about in Oregon and putting together shindigs and gatherings much like this. And we wanted to extend an invitation to you since you were so kind to invite us here to this community. There are two things coming up that we want to let you know about. In October, we'll be in Eugene and in Portland, respectively, for what we call the annual meetings. What you got here is a little overview of what we do in terms of our work. You'll get a broader perspective active if you join us for one of those events. We have another event in March of next year, March 9th to be exact. It's the largest gathering that we have. It takes place in Portland. We call it the Liberty Dinner. Come and join us, break bread with like minds and with your friends and your family and the rest of your community, and have a bit of fun. We always bring in an amazing speaker. This year's keynote speaker was someone named Dahlia Lithwick, who's an amazing journalist who has written for a number of publications, including the New York Times. She's been featured on Rachel Maddow. So if you come with us for that evening, you won't be disappointed. I also wanted to do something a little bit different. When Kit Ketchum, and we had a little bit of discussion about this, whether I reached out to her or whether she reached out to me, and I can't really remember how it happened, but when she and I and Christina started talking about us coming to Astoria, there were two things that were quite clear to us. One was that you wanted to hear about our work and how it unfolds on the ground to make sure that, as Nancy said, democracy is something that's available to everybody, that the founding documents, the Bill of Rights, which enshrines our civil liberties and our civil rights, are both a living document and seen in everyone's life, right? You want to hear about the impact of our work, and you also wanted to hear about how you can support us. When you hear the story that Nancy told, which is a fairly profound one, or even the things that Sarah and David talked about in their conversation points, what you hear is that there are 8 people, about to be 10 staff members, at the ACLU who are super passionate about doing the work. And let me talk about the November 8th reality. Before November the 9th, before the Trump administration took its hold on our nation, we had 2,500 people that reached out to us that who came to us saying that their civil liberties or their civil rights was violated in some way. That was by telephone calls, letters, emails, etc. That's 2,500 before November 9th. The work that we have has expanded exponentially. And when we looked at it, before November the 7th, we had roughly 7,000 members. We've gone to 43,000. And each one of those people who have decided to support us in some way, we thank you. But if you're here today and you're not a member of the ACLU, I invite you to join us. Become a part of the movement. I'm asking you to join if you believe that what you've heard about tonight is important, that you believe deeply in civil liberties and civil rights for everyone. I'm asking you to become a part of that movement. Our colleague that we spoke about, Kimberly McCullough, who does an amazing job in Salem, gets the opportunity to go in, speak about issues that we know that you're super passionate about. And when she says to legislators that there are 43,000 people that believe in this, believe me, they take notice of that. Help us make it 44. Help us make it 50,000. I'm asking you to commit to supporting work that makes sure that everybody, your friends, your families, your neighbors, enjoy democracy in the same way. Because as we've alluded to and explicitly laid out in this conversation, while Oregon is exceptional in some ways, there's still fights to be had. And we're ready to continue that fight. But we need your support. You have something that says join. If you're interested in doing that, fill that out and give it to one of us on staff. We'll be happy to help you become a part of the movement. Having said all that, I want to invite my colleagues back up here, Sarah and David. We're going to open up the conversation to a standard Q&A portion. We actually have 2 microphones there, and we'd invite you to go to the microphone and make your comment or question so that everyone would have the opportunity to hear you.
You know, I'm sorry, actually. I don't think that is... we're going to be able to give you more information on that. I do think that is really troubling to hear about, and it's I think indicative of this ideology that somehow government is holding us back, and we don't actually recognize that in fact the existence of inspectors, for example, is one of the things that actually keeps us alive. And I think that we need to be generally pushing back on this notion that we don't benefit from government. But I thank you for flagging that. That's something I'm going to look into. Okay. That's a great question. I think that there are a number of reasons for that. One of the reasons is that it's a it's a down ballot race. And so what I mean by that is that when you open up your ballot, it's one of the last things that appears. And so there are a lot of people that are not going all the way down the ballot. About 40% of Oregonians that in fact are voting on other races are not voting for district attorney. Because most people actually don't know about these races. I think that there's often less likely to be candidates who can imagine themselves being able to take on an incumbent. The value of incumbency actually is pretty significant. That's beginning to change in other parts of the country. We're seeing reform-minded candidates step up and jump into district attorney races. And we've seen just actually 2 days ago, a civil rights attorney won the election for the Philadelphia's district attorney race. 10 years ago, 5 years ago, no one probably would have imagined that this person would be the Philadelphia district attorney. So I don't think that the dynamic that is now doesn't have to be the dynamic that continues to be. And if you know anyone who's thinking about who could run for district attorney, has a progressive analysis, is concerned about criminal justice reform, it's time for us to start encouraging people to think seriously about jumping in. You know, we're about 3 or 4 weeks away from releasing or kind of launching a website that is specifically focused on district attorney accountability. And if you're connected to our Facebook, if you're on our Action Alert network, you will hear about it. So we wanted to give you a sneak preview. The trick about, first of all, it's worth noting that Oregon currently has a moratorium in place. So it was first initiated by Governor Kitzhaber, and Governor Brown has decided to hold that into place. In order for, because it's in our Constitution, it would have to go before voters. It's a scary prospect. I'm not frankly sure that we're entirely there in terms of public opinion to be able to do that successfully. So advocates who are working towards abolition of the death penalty are trying to be strategic, because actually putting it on the ballot could be a huge setback. The first thing is we need to keep the moratorium in place. People have been communicating effectively to the governor. I think that she'll continue to do that. There have been people who have communicated to the governor to try and get her to seriously consider commuting the row. I think it actually is under serious consideration at the governor's office. It's certainly unlikely to happen while we're still during a legislative session. We need to focus on that. But I would encourage people to reach out to the governor who want to abolish the death penalty in July and encourage her to commute the row. That would be a huge step forward.
You talked a little bit about the grand juries, and I remember being on one a long time ago and being a bit bewildered about what my role as a grand juror was. Is there any efforts to have, even if it's a simple pamphlet, that necessarily wouldn't have to come from the county courthouse, but maybe from you, that would explain to grand jury candidates what their obligations are and what their duties are and why they're there? Because I had a vague idea, and I don't think some of the other grand jurors in my grand jury were aware of what their role was. It seemed to be crank the handle and just say yes to whatever the district attorney wanted. Yeah. Is there any movement? And I have another question, but go ahead.
Yeah, I will say this. I think that that's an excellent idea. I'm actually going to take it back and speak to a variety of people that we work with around statewide policy and see if we can get the judicial branch here to to engage in that kind of education more intentionally. Thank you for mentioning that. Okay.
And the other thing, just doing YouTube surfing, sometimes I'll run across videos taken by somebody who puts their cell phone camera on their vehicle seat, and they get stopped at an ICE checkpoint that's not at the border, that's maybe 50 miles away from the border, and they go through a process of not answering questions. The first question that the border officer has is, are you an American citizen? And they're met by stone silence from the people in the car. It seems a bit risky to do, but are you on a legal basis for not answering those kinds of questions?
That's a good question. You definitely have the right to remain silent at any time. I think when you're actually crossing a border, things are a little bit different, including with searches.
Right. I understand that part of it. Yeah.
But what you're asking about is the fact that Customs and Border Control can have and does in certain areas of the country have a checkpoint anywhere within 100 miles of a border, and a lot of people don't know that. So Astoria is obviously included because you're right on the border, actually. Even though there's not another country to cross to right here, that still counts. And actually, it gets a lot of Oregon that way. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure those people are allowed to do that, to not answer the questions. But I think that just like it would in any law enforcement encounter, it can make it more difficult, actually, right. Make mm-hmm. it take longer. And so really, people are put into a situation where they have to decide, you have to always keep your safety in mind. Mm-hmm. And in most law enforcement encounters, you can always, the one way to know, and it doesn't count for this particular question because you're in your car, but you can always say, am I free to leave or are you detaining me?
Right.
And if they say they're detaining you, then that kind of clicks into the next level.
Right.
And you know now that you're not free to leave and you're being detained. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, if they don't answer or they say no, you're free to go and you can just leave. And that's what the kind of thing that we go around to schools and stuff and teach kids about this, and also grown-ups too, for people, because it's super intimidating when you're encountering law enforcement. And I've seen those videos too. And it's like, so it's basically a way that certain people sort of protest the existence of the checkpoints. Because they feel so very un-American, really. Because it's not supposed to be a show me your papers country.
Right.
So, okay. But thank you. Okay. Yeah.
Hi. I just had a general question. I've always been interested in how the ACLU goes about determining what they're going to fight for or not. I was always under the impression that the ACLU is about constitutional rights. They look at the Constitution and say, okay, someone's rights are being violated, and here's the amendment that says essentially that they are. Can you elaborate a little bit more on your process and how you choose what cases to take and how you fight them? Mm-hmm.
Let me take a stab. Yeah, I think that there's, you know, we kind of have like a set of questions we ask ourselves when we're talking about legal cases in particular. Mm-hmm. And so we have our issue areas that are just the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, the rights that are outlined there, which includes just equal treatment under the law for people. I think one of the lenses that we put on when we make a decision is, will this affect more than just that one client? Does this have a wider effect? Mm-hmm. And so we try to take impact cases in that way. So we represented Carrie Medina with her Film the Police lawsuit, but it was really for every Oregonian who wants to film a police encounter. You know, it extends past her. We also try to focus our work to make sure that people who have traditionally been excluded from rights and privileges under the Bill of Rights and Constitution are able to enjoy them. So we use that lens to pick cases. And then I think, you know, we also tap, you know, our staff, our board of directors, and other allies and groups in Oregon to look ahead at the future and say, you know, where, if we focus our efforts, where can we really make a significant change? Where can we really move the needle? Like David told you earlier, Oregon's a unique place. We really can make changes that the rest of the country can look to and say, well, look, hey, we're not as crazy as Oregon. Look what they're doing. We'll just set the needle right here in the middle here in Kansas, but Oregon's way over here with their ideas, right? So we try to keep those kinds of things in mind, too. Do you have anything you want to add, David? Does that answer it?
Yeah, it does.
Okay,
yeah,
great. Thanks.
Hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for your attention and your fight for the privacy through the internet. I think that's probably one of the most striking, wide-ranging issues that the entire public each has a responsibility for. I'm kind of puzzled. Social justice is, it works out that social justice is something that we're supposed to have, and as I sit at home, in a home I own, on a personal computer I purchased, in my little table, in my workspace, and I go to my insurance company, or I go to Amazon, or I go to Facebook, or any of the others, are those not First Amendment rights? Are those not choices that I'm expressing as a First Amendment, that I'm given certain rights with all of these mechanisms and our freedoms and our citizenship, that is part and parcel of the First Amendment? So I don't understand how we even got into the fight to begin with and how these guys get paid off in Congress to fight on that. My other pet peeve, I know you guys are really involved in that, so you don't have to answer that. My other pet peeve is kind of rhetorical. It involves credit scores. And I'm not sure if we're all caught between unwarranted assumptions of, you know, credit companies and retail stores and the outright, social justice retardation of our views about who constitutes in the public the right to be without exploitation. In other words, why are the, it's rhetorical, but it is the poorest people that are given the highest interest rates on a car, the highest interest rates on their insurance or the costs of insurance or the house that they want to buy. And it just makes it's a terrible exploitation of these people, even though they may have, you know, experienced some financial indignity, of their own that they need to overcome. So I don't know. I would hope that there's something that could be done in the future about something like that, because I think it's a terrible injustice. Thank you.
Thanks. Well, I will just say super quickly that it is really problematic that credit scores are increasingly being used to be able to figure out who has access to certain employment opportunities, housing opportunities, and it's something that is a conversation that's beginning to bubble up. I think it deserves a great deal of attention, and I appreciate your flagging economic justice issues. I mean, we are at a point now where economic inequality is really at a peak in the history of our country, and we are heading terribly in the wrong direction around that. The ways that we can lift up visibility around that and begin to bring that lens will be really critical. So thank you for that.
And I'll just say on the privacy front that, one of the core freedoms of the United States is a freedom from unreasonable searches and seizures and a right to privacy. And in the digital age and the internet age, it's so much easier for companies and the government to know so much more about us based on the tracking devices we carry around. I mean, our phones and the internet, you know, and like you said, we do a lot of things on there. And so at the ACLU, I think we've been a leader to say that, yes, we should all be able to enjoy all of the things that this technology brings to us, but no, you shouldn't be able to take our information and use it without our knowledge, companies, and government. No, you shouldn't be spying on us with mass surveillance tools. You know, we have more work to do because there is government overreach, and as we can see with this law that we talked about in Congress, Washington, D.C. and the Trump administration doesn't have our back on these issues. So there's more to do. Thank you. Thank you. And is that it? Is that a good wrap-up place? Yeah. There's more work to do?
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.